Hello, everyone. Welcome to Cybersecurity Matters. My name is Christian, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Dominic Vogel. Dominic, who do we have in the virtual hot seat today for our virtual episode?
Well, we have a very entertaining Scotsman, Alan Williamson. He is the Chief Technology Officer and partner at the McLaurin Group. Just by the few times I've talked with him, incredibly engaging personality. This will be a fun conversation.
So we will bring Alan on, and we will be right back.
Alan, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join Christian and I. I have no doubts about this. This will be a fantastic convo, so we're really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, and thanks for setting the bar high there, so we've got to be good.
It's good to set the tone right out of the gate. So we see this.
We can only go down from here.
That's right.
It's like a slide. By the end of this episode, it might just be terrible, but that's okay. So we'll start off on a high note. We can see the sign behind you, the McLaurin Group. What is the McLaurin Group?
So essentially, we provide outsourced operating services in technical and data for private equity companies. So private equity companies are very well versed in finance, sales, marketing, HR, but there's a little blind spot sometimes regarding technology. So We operate as if we were an operating partner. I've come from that space, so I know what an operating partner is. And we help with their portfolios, both pre and post transactions.
Okay. And I know you have a new book coming out, so I'm excited to see it and read it. It's called the CTO Handbook. So first of all, there's all these terms, CISO, CIO, CTO, and sometimes in different companies, it can be interchangeable what the actual job descriptions are. But in your definition, what is a CTO or a chief technology officer?
Yeah, it's a great question because sometimes, you know, VP of engineering sometimes goes in there and muddies up the water as well. So a CTO is primarily the person that's responsible for the technology vision of the company and delivering that technology vision in the pursuit of happiness of customers.
Got it. And so what is the book going to be about?
It's basically going to be a book for the new time CTO, or the CTO that feels like I should be doing more, or what else could I be doing? What else should I be doing? From both startup to founder-led companies to private equity type companies, anybody that's got a team of say maybe 100 engineers or less, around about the 200 million and less type revenue of company, this is what this book is for. It's filled with lots of case studies, lots of how-tos. We're not going to tell you, for example, choose Java over C Sharp. We're not going to tell you choose Amazon over Azure. We're going to help you figure out how to make those decisions in the context of your business. So what makes sense for you as opposed to saying, thou shalt go this way and thou shalt go this way.
Right. So when I actually read the book, I'll be reading it with your voice, hearing your Scottish accent as the words are pronounced in my mind.
So correct. And I've got lots of quotes from many a colleagues from over the years. So I'm excited to get it out.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. In terms of your like what you see, and I'm sure you've come across, you know, the good, bad, and ugly in terms of all sorts of different CTOs, you know, in this age that we are in right now in 2020, what qualities make for a good CTO? Like, not necessarily the technical qualities, but like the leadership qualities, the human qualities, the foundational skills. What skill set makes for a great CTO?
I think, and this one was heavily debated internally as well, communication. CTOs generally sort of, we have a tendency to suck at communicating, right? We say, for example, we're building.
Thank you for saving us a lot of time on this episode. Cut straight to the chase.
So we're building a toaster, and the CTO, as a technologist, because that's usually their background, will get fixated about how we're toasting the toast. It could be infrared, it could be electricity, it could be gas. We're really loving about the whole how we're doing the toast. The CEO, however, don't care about that. It just, is my bread brown? Yes or no? And then the board above them is, well, how many of the breads can you produce? X number of units, et cetera, right? So whenever a CTO is usually communicating up, what we've discovered is, and where we help with a lot of the mentoring is, you're not actually talking to the CEO. Yes, you're physically talking to the CEO, but you're giving them the sound bites to which to not only action what you're giving them, but also for them to communicate to their board or their private equity people as if they now have got a full understanding of what it is you're trying to say. So too much times, the CTO will bog themselves down into technical terms and buzzwords and not trying to sort of relate or empathize with the person that they're talking to.
Interesting. And you know, I, for me as well, you know, I've, over the past 15 years, I've come across all sorts of different, great, technically, skilled people who've been elevated into, positions of authority and leadership. But they're terrible leaders, you see this, and especially in, I would say in larger organizations as well, in which, sometimes just because someone's been there for 20 years, okay, now they deserve a shot at the CTO chair or the CIO chair or what have you. So if you're someone in sort of that, within an organization and you're looking at your team and all the resources and components within there, how important is it to start cultivating, leadership skills and empathy skills and just, seeing beyond the technical skills? Because I see with a lot of organizations, yes, they may invest in technically training their IT/technical team, but not from a business perspective or from even just a human perspective or leadership perspective. So how important is that to be able to start that early on rather than, let's say you're now a 50-year-old CTO, is that a skill set you can suddenly start developing?
You got to start it early. And when I mean start it early, the CTO or the leader has to show by example internally. So for example, to your juniorist developer or support person, they have to have a handle on what does that other department do? What does our customers actually do? Yeah. And stay, sometimes it's blinkered and they stay inside their own little safe zone and say, I produce JavaScript code and all I'm going to do is produce JavaScript code. I don't care who runs the JavaScript code. It seems to pass SonarQube every so often, so it seems to be good, and they keep paying me, so everything's good. No, you need to emphasize with the person that's going to be using your code to figure out, is that it there? Now, I say code, it could be services, it could be anything inside the world, but fundamentally, do you have a handle on people outside of your department? Now, if you get that early enough, Dom, it'll continue to grow as you go up the ranks.
Yeah.
And because the person you're speaking to is usually going to be a peer, and that could be another C level, or it could be the above level, which could be board member, etc. And they have no technical jargon whatsoever, by and large, right? Mm-hmm. As far as they're concerned, the cloud is this infinite scalable, nothing will ever go wrong in the cloud type sort of stuff. We need to get security. Let's buy some security. See, that's the level that they're at. And that's the level they should be at in many respects, because they're hiring a CTO to cover the ground that they don't need to worry about. They need to be aware of it, but that's why we hire experts, is to let the experts do what the experts do.
For sure. No, that's a great response there, Alan.
So Alan, when you're engaging with your clients, and I'm thinking more initially in the first parts of the engagement, how big of a role does demystifying technology play for you, and how do you go about doing that?
So the demystifying, Christian, came around simply because when we did our initial due diligence, you go in and it's like a home inspection report, and people always expect to find problems. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we're not really there to look for problems and prod stuff. We're there to sort of figure out what's our big items that could possibly make a deal go wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're not really caring if you don't really have a coding standard, you don't, not that interested in that stuff. We're looking for the big items. So when we do find a big item, how do we communicate that to both the private equity team that's on mm-hmm. the sales group and also the CEO or the leadership inside of the portfolio for them to be able to fix it? And that's where the demystifying just kept in, because we kept finding ourselves having to sort of distill these complicated engineering problems down into a way to say, okay, here is what that means in a language that you can understand, right? So do you remember the great scene from Blazing Saddles towards the end of the movie?
I have not seen that movie.
Oh, come on, Christian. I may have to end this interview now.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
walk off, our first walk
so,
off.
So there's a bit at the end of the movie where they've created the Rock Ridge town, and they're trying to slow the raiders coming into the Rock Ridge town. What do? They put up a toll booth.
Yeah.
And the toll booth, if you remember, has no fences around it. You could go around the toll booth. And we use that example so many times because this is what your security is. Your security is a toll booth in Blazing Saddles. It's got a fancy ring. You get a ticket. You put your money in. It feels secure, but you could walk around it. That's your security. So that's where the demystifying technology has come in. Is putting it in. Now, when you say that to somebody, they instantly go, "Really? Our security is as bad as that?" Yes. The other one we use is, "Yeah, you've left the key under the mat."
Yeah.
It's a great door and the lock is brilliant, but the key's there, right? That's fine. So you find ways to explain that. And then when somebody challenges you on it, well, so here's the technical detail. Here's where the key is under the mat. And here's what a key looks like in the digital world. So, and that's where it came from.
Yeah, it's interesting with that first analogy there with the toll booth. Cyber criminals don't typically have that compliant personality that would go, "Are we allowed to? Are we supposed to? We're going to go there and get a ticket." They're quite easily obviously going to go around it. So
I love the Blazing Saddles reference. It's been a long, long time since I've heard of a Blazing Saddles reference. At first, I thought you were going to reference the bit where they're all around the campfire there when the over flatulence.
Well, that's another problem, but you haven't spoken about that one.
That's at a people level.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
you've got great team synergy there, people. Yeah.
I'm going to rewatch that tonight. I'm looking forward. It's been years since I've seen that, so that's awesome. Something we were talking about before we started recording here was. You're saying that in terms of that overall due diligence, that you're starting to see security now being actively part of a overall due diligence process. I'm curious, when did you start sort of seeing that tide change and how has that progressed?
Well, I think it's been largely driven by the media. It's given that the big massive breaches, etc., is hitting the likes of, you know, the BBC, CNN, all the usual suspects. Yeah. Your average person in the street is now far more aware of what data leakage, privacy, and all that means now. So it's now become a little bit more fashionable to talk about it. And I would say that it has started to turn around because nobody wants to be on the front page.
Yeah.
We don't like to read about a competitor being on the front page, but we don't want to see ourselves on the front page, right? So as the private equity company is going through all this sort of due diligence and what have you, privacy, particularly, and also with the European data laws changing as well, it has made a sort of a major focus now to say who owns this data?
Yeah.
Where, and particularly when companies would boast of large data sets and what have you, you'd say, okay, well, let's drill down into that a little bit. Are this data really yours? How anonymized is it? If it is anonymized, can it be reverse engineered? Who owns it? Where is it parked? Where's your backups? So there's been a lot more attention to the overall stewardship of data. And as part of that, security has now become a lot more integral into the who can see it and what can they do with it. And from that perspective, I would say in the last sort of 5 years on the outset, maybe three to two years, deals are now starting to not go through because of something that's been found at the security side of the fence. Before, it would have been usually something that could have been quickly fixed. Yeah. But just like when you buy a house, you get insurance on the house just in case that, you know, something wasn't disclosed, et cetera, and you can basically return the house in 30 days type sort of scenario. Yeah. You get the same sort of thing when you're buying a company. Now, these policies last for like 20 odd years, et cetera, because it's usually tax. You forgot to file with the IRS, and the new owners don't want to be responsible for the fact that you didn't file with the IRS 15 years ago.
Right.
But now security's coming there where it's hard for them to get the insurance if the due diligence has thrown up a known security hole. Mm-hmm. And now you sort of have to dig into the sort of, well, did you know about it? No. Then that's okay. Then let's try and fix it. Did you know about it? But nobody's ever hit it. Yeah. That's cute. But again, it's all about trying to figure out what you've got. And as part of our sort of mantra, as part of it, as well as demystifying, is trust but verify. You know, we don't go in there and sort of do the two bobs routine from Office Space and say, so what would you say you do here?
That's a movie I've seen.
Alan. Yes,
I can follow along with you on this one. One of my favorite ones.
So we don't sit. We have a conversation with them. We're not going through an Excel spreadsheet of questions answering. Yeah. It's more conversational, right?
Sure.
And depending on what the PE firm wants to do with the company will determine where our conversation goes, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I'm buying a house because I need to have two more bedrooms for the expanding family I'm going to have, I'm focusing on the size of the house, not the fancy little ornate garden at the back, because I'm not really interested in the ornate garden in the back. I'm more interested in the bedrooms, right?
Sure.
Same thing in a company. We're always focusing in on what the PE firm wants to do. So from that perspective, we'll have a conversation, but we'll actually ask them to show us and prove it to us and say, yeah, do we store passwords in a database? No, we don't. Great. Take me through it. I want to see the exact line of code that actually checks the password.
Yeah.
And then show me the cell in the database field that actually has the password. Is that hashed? Show me the hashing algorithm. Great, that's fine. Tick box. We're off to the races. So, and that's a very trivial example, of course. Yep. You know, but fundamentally, it's all about making sure that there's no surprises at the other side. And we're not there to trick them. We're there to make sure that it's an honest conversation, because 9 times out of 10, by the time we're in the due diligence phase, the company's probably going to be sold.
Right.
And it's probably going to be the group that we're representing that's going to buy it, because it's an awful lot of money to go through the whole buying process. So by the time it gets to that level of due diligence, it's a final tick to make sure things are going fine. And at that point, we're not there to trick them. We're there to be their partners and sort of help them. And there's been a number of times where it's like, okay, let's work together and fix this now, because it's an easy fix. And it doesn't need to go any further than it is. And it's not a case of that there was any malicious intent. It's just sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. You're sort of heads down, focused in. Very common in founder-led companies whereby the CTO has effectively been the graduate of a school 20 years ago and knows no other environment but this, all self-taught. And there are large gaps. Yeah. If only there was a CTO book they could help with. So that then sort of, it's just a case that they haven't had that mentor or that senior person to sort of say, hey, have you thought of this? Have you thought of this?
Yeah, it's so important what you're saying, Alan, because evaluating in a due diligence process the technology and the cybersecurity of a company, you effectively, as the acquirer, are buying the data of the company and the information systems, and you're also inheriting the weaknesses within that company. And if that isn't properly looked at to the level of detail that you're walking your clients through and putting companies through, it could be a nasty surprise or a ticking time bomb down the road.
And the ticking time bomb is absolutely perfect. I mean, it's something that we do a lot of as well, is just go through contracts to make sure that the data you've licensed is in actual fact yours to license, and does it maintain over a transaction. You'd be surprised the amount of times where, okay, no, it's stop at this point. We've got to renegotiate that contract. Mm-hmm. You're thinking, oh, that value of data I thought I had, I don't have.
Mm-hmm. So when you're engaging with a client, obviously, there is a way that you can be most effective and really partner with your clients and your firm. What are some of the challenges that you face that makes it hard for a company for you to help be helpful to a company? And maybe what are some of the myths that you run into from a cybersecurity perspective or a technology perspective?
COVID has really been a pain in the bum. We like to get face to face with the people.
Right.
We like to get sat down, and it's not an interrogation. It's not a, you know, when people hear due diligence, they conjure up, you know, like a police detective, and it's like Luther in a dark room with a camera. No, that's just this podcast. We just got to figure out how to get onto that personal level for them to feel that we're here with them. And we're probably going to find things that we're going to be able to fix there and then, but let's do this together. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, as we all know ourselves, the human touch outside of 6 feet is wonderful. And to know that when you're looking at somebody in the eye, that it's genuine, you're not there to trick them up. You're not there to be an asshole.
Yeah.
You're there to genuinely lift them up. And we get a lot of great feedback in terms of, we actually thoroughly enjoyed that. That didn't feel like a due diligence. Mm-hmm. That we learned something from this. Now, everybody's nervous as hell to begin with because nobody knows what they're doing. And we send them videos, we send them how-to manuals to prepare them to say, right, this is not an interrogation. This is going to be a... We're celebrating what you're doing. And the odd time where you get, you know, security is a hot one inside of the cloud, because there's this assumption that if you do a couple of things inside of AWS, for example, then you're instantly secure. Mm-hmm. So there's that sort of, well, I don't have physical machines and I'm doing sort of stuff. And you're thinking, no, okay, but you've mixed your development environment in with your production environment, or you're still making people go into SSH keys onto all your servers, for example, or your IAM policies, you've still got your root one still there, but nobody had ever said, you maybe turn that off.
Yeah.
And the amount of times we said, we'll just turn it off now. There's no need for that to be there like that. Or there's no need to be sort of some stuff. And we fix some of those problems as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Alan, I'm so excited to be able to for us to do a crossover episode, because I know with your podcast, to continue this conversation. You know, we're up against the clock here, and it's fun when you have a great engaging personality like yourself. Time flies right by, and that was just an absolutely incredible conversation. Plus all those cultural references, I'd say this is one of the more entertaining combos we've had.
More entertaining, more edgy.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. but we're looking forward to, like I said, continuing the conversation on your podcast. We're going to definitely have you back on this show. Thoroughly enjoy this conversation. Thank you very, very much. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been an honor.
Enjoy the rest of your day, sir. Have a good one.
Talk to you soon, Alan.
And Chris and I are going to be right back momentarily to wrap things up on today's show.
Awesome person, Alan. I so enjoyed that conversation. He pushed us to the edges and brought us a few laughs, and I love that Scottish accent. Yep. And I think the thing that stood out to me in their due diligence focus with technology and cybersecurity is, yes, trust what people say, but also verify, because it can mean a big difference in a deal transaction.
Absolutely. You know, he has such great wisdom, but you know, such a great personality weighed against that, in which, you know, the Blazing Saddles reference, Office Space reference, boy, it's going to be fun doing a crossover episode with him on his podcast. That'll be a blast.
Awesome. So thanks everybody for watching. You can check out our other podcasts on conversationsthatmatter.tv, or you can listen to us wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. And we'll see you next week.